You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Monday, where it's 85 degrees in the studio, because the Heritage Foundation has turned the heat on, but not the AC, but it's like 70 out. And anyway, what can you say? These old buildings, you know, they either have heat or AC, but they're not capable of both. Welcome to the program. There's a lot going on that obviously this is the week before the election. And in fact, for many people, it's the week of the election because there are many states that have early voting. And that week of the election, there's some pretty significant stuff going on with regard to the election. Let me just, you know, jump through some of this. First of all, Mitch McConnell, this has got to be a shock. The Lexington Herald Leader, the I believe it's the number one newspaper in his state, has basically gone after him in an op-ed. They endorsed Allison Lundgren Grimes. And about McConnell, they said, "The problem is how McConnell uses his power. He has repeatedly hurt the country to advance his political strategy." The Think Caucus Room Conspiracy, right? Back to the op-ed in the Lexington Herald Leader. McConnell has sabotaged jobs and transportation bills, even as Kentucky's unemployment exceeds the nation's average, and an Interstate 75 bridge crumbles over the Ohio River. He blocked tax credits for companies to move jobs back to this country while preserving tax breaks for those who move jobs overseas. He opposed extending unemployment benefits while bemoaning the jobless recovery. He brags about resolving crises that he helped create. The Senate may never recover from the bitter paralysis McConnell has inflicted through record filibusters that allow his minority to rule by obstruction. Kentuck has posted that over at Democratic Underground, but the original's over at Kentucky.com at the Lexington Herald Leader site. Meanwhile, there's a really interesting lesson here. I don't know if you've noticed, but Elizabeth Warren is showing up in a lot of places. She showed up in Kentucky to stump, you know, to campaign for Elizabeth Lundgren Grimes, who has been trying to portray herself as, "Oh, I'm not that middle of the road Obama Democrat." But then here comes Elizabeth Warren, who is like a genuine progressive. People love her. So what does this say about the Democratic strategy of, let's be like, you know, on some issues, let's just be Republican light, because then the Republicans will treat us nicely, right? You got the Republicans running around saying Social Security is doomed. It's going to fail. It's going to die. Blah, de, blah, de, blah, which is really their way of saying, please don't raise the cap and make rich people pay into Social Security the way that working people and poor people have to pay into Social Security. Because, you know, I mean, if you live below the poverty line and you're working at McDonald's or something and you're making $8,000 or $9,000 a year, every single penny of income that you earn is fully taxed to pay for Social Security. Whereas, you know, if you're David Koch and you made $1 billion last year, only the first 118,000 were taxed for Social Security, and the next 900,000 roughly, no tax. The next 10 million, 30 billion, million, 50 million, 100 million, 200 million, 300 million, 400 million, 500 million, 600 million, 700 million, 800 million, 900 million, 1,000 million. None of those are taxed at all to pay for Social Security. Because Social Security is not a flat tax. It's a tax exclusively on people who make under $118,000. Basically, people in the middle class and poor people, the working poor. So the Republicans have been running around going, "Oh my God, Social Security's going to die. We need to give it to Wall Street. Quick, give it to Jamie Dimon." And there's been a few Democrats who've said, "Okay, if this is the, this is where America's at. This is what America believes." I mean, you got Simpson and Bowles running around saying this. and being paid $40,000 a whack to give speeches before groups that, you know, would love to get their hands on Social Security's money. Yes, Simpson's a Republican. Bowles was a Democrat. Both of them are now simply irrelevant. But there's been a few Democrats who said, okay, you know, I'll go along with that. I'll sign on for the chain CPI. Even Obama signed on for a little while. Bernie Sanders started the Save Social Security Caucus in the United States Senate, and they actually went after Obama and the Democrats on this and got Obama to back off from it and got the Democratic Party to back off from it. But there's still a few individual Democrats who think maybe it's a good idea to do the chain CPI. Now, a chain CPI is a way of cutting Social Security payouts so that Social Security rises more slowly than the rate of inflation. And here's how it works. Every year, the Social Security Administration, through, I think, the Department of Labor compiles the numbers, but, you know, through some government agency, says, okay, how much has the cost of living gone up? How much inflation do we have? And they look at that and they say, okay, gee, the cost of chicken has gone up, or the cost of steak has gone up 20% this year. The cost of iPods have gone down 10% this year. So net inflation is up 10%. Or the cost of iPods have gone down 20%. So it's a wash. There's no inflation. Now, one of the main criticisms against that form of calculation is that computers and iPods and gadgets and things are not heavily used by people on Social Security. Rather, we should be looking at the cost of transportation that you don't own. Have taxi fares gone up? Number one. Number two, cost of increase in health care. Number three, cost of increase in prescription. They're all going up far more than 1.7% a year. But this whole chain CPI idea, and so Bernie has been saying, you know, we need to actually have a more reasonable number. But the chain CPI idea is you chain the cost of living to behavior. So if the price of steak goes up, the assumption is if your Social Security revenue does not go up, that you'll switch from, now I have no idea what meat costs. I haven't bought meat since I was 17 years old. But so I'm just going to make up some numbers here. So you'll switch from $10 a pound steak to $3 a pound hamburger, right? You know, assuming that I'm even randomly close to reality here on these numbers. So actually, the cost of living has gone down for people on Social Security because they've changed their behavior. They're now eating hamburger instead of steak. Now let's see, hamburger goes up more than 2% a year. So then they say, well, people stopped eating hamburger and they started eating chicken, which is a buck and a half a pound or whatever it is. And if the cost of chicken goes up too much, they'll say, okay, people have stopped eating chicken and they're starting to eat cat food, which is only 50 cents a pound. Which is one of the reasons why people call this, you know, the cat food budget, the Simpson-Bowles cat food commission. So here's where it gets interesting. Crossroads GPS, the National Republican Campaign Committee, Crossroads GPS is Karl Rove's group. They are running ads attacking Representative John Barlow, a Democrat in Georgia, saying that he is leaving Georgia seniors behind by supporting a plan that would raise the retirement age to 69 while cutting Social Security benefits. Karl Rove's group has attacked Senator Kay Hagan, Democrat of North Carolina, Arkansas Senator Democrat Mark Pryor, Democratic Congressman Scott Peters in California, all of supporting a controversial plan that cuts Social Security benefits. What is it that these Democrats all support? A chain CPI, which was originally a Republican idea. So here you have Mark Pryor, Kay Hagan, Scott Peters, John Barrow, Democrats who were dumb enough or who were listening to political consultants who were stupid enough to believe that if you become a little bit Republican, the Republicans won't pick on you, they'll like you. No, I'm sorry, they're still going to pick on you, they're going to lie about you, they're going to attack you, and they might well beat you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But that's only one piece of it. There's a lot more. Stick around. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Corky, watching Free Speech TV in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I'm working hard to get the Democrats elected. As soon as we get them elected, then we can get rid of people like Kay Hagan and the rest of them.
Well, I don't think we need to get rid of them. I think we need to wake them up to the policies that the vast majority of Americans want. I don't think Kay Hagan decided that she wanted to be a conservative. I think she thinks it's the way to win because she's listening to these idiotic political consultants.
Drag them over to the progressive side. That's what I mean.
Yeah. Wake them up.
But I think the big issue here is I wish these politicians are running on is that college student loan debt, because that not only encompasses the students, it also encompasses the parents who have to sign for the loans and the grandparents.
Yeah.
And you can't file bankruptcy against student loans. That's how they screwed it.
Yeah, and that was specifically throwing the bone to the banksters, because now that you can't declare bankruptcy on these loans, the banksters can package them and create derivatives and out of them hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives based on them, and they are more secure, more stable, more reliable than home loans, home mortgages. So we're creating a whole brand new bubble based on student loan debt. And it's
exactly.
Not the student loan debt. It is the derivatives that are being made from them. But here's the point, Corky, that Democrats should do. Let me take your suggestion and take it a step farther. When Republicans are running for office, they put things on the ballot which they know will never, ever win. They put things like, and actually some of them have been winning recently or may win, but for 40 years now, ever since 1973, Republicans have been putting on the ballot on a statewide level. They put on things like, a ban on abortion or these personhood amendments or ending abortion, late term abortion or banning gays from marrying, which 10 years ago worked, now doesn't. But basically they would put things on the ballot they don't care if it wins or not. They just know it's going to activate the base and get the base out. If the Democrats had any brains at all, political brains. I realize, some Democrats are very smart, but if the Democratic leadership, if the people running the Democratic Party and deciding Democratic strategy had any brains at all, they would come up with a law that could be put on the ballot. So I guess in most states it would have to be their constitutional amendment or a law passed by the people that they could put on the ballot that says that student loans, that there's a complete amnesty on student loans, or that student loans are now eligible for directly from the Fed at 0.1%, the same rate the banks borrow at. Some pie in the sky thing that's going to help students, right? I mean, really push it all the way to the edge. Outlawing tuition in the state. All state institutions have to be free. Anything like that. What that would do for Democrats is the same thing that something on the ballot that says, they can't take away your guns. Women don't have a right to abortion. Resegregate schools, whatever. I mean, all these things have variations of them on the ballots in Republican states for years. It would bring out the base. It would bring out young people. It would bring out people that don't normally vote. And Democrats are failing to do this. They're accidentally doing it in three states with marijuana initiatives, but they should be doing it far more explicitly. And I think, Corky, you nailed it. Thanks for the call. Bring in the students. And do it by saying, we want to go back to Abe Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson. Free tuition. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour. So, step one from a Democratic strategy point of view, I mean, it's like, look at Al Franken, Al Franken is running a race. He hasn't given in to any of the conservatives' nonsense. And, he's in a fairly blue state, but still, is Michelle Bachmann Minnesota or Wisconsin? She's Minnesota. Yeah, I mean, there's Republicans in Minnesota. What Al Franken has done is said, here's where I am. I'm not going to compromise. I'm going to, and he's going to be a thoughtful senator, and he asks meaningful questions, and he doesn't grandstand a lot. And, it works well. Democrats really should take a lesson from Al Franken or from Bernie Sanders or from Sherrod Brown. I mean, Ohio has got John Boehner. I mean, Ohio is a swing state. And yet Sherrod Brown wins there. Why? Because he's a solid progressive who doesn't compromise his values. So if you were to put a thing on the ballot that says that the bankruptcy laws can be used to discharge student loans, for example. You know, you don't have to expect it to win. The banksters will come out, they'll spend millions of dollars making sure it's defeated. But you get your base out. You get young people to vote by putting something on the ballot that they care about. It's very straightforward stuff. I mean, Republicans did this for years. They would put, you know, In God We Trust on the ballot. They would put late-term abortion on the ballot. They would put gay marriage on the ballot. They would put you can't take away guns in our state on the ballot. Any little thing that they thought was going to appeal to some wedge of the electorate that could get them another 1 or 2 or 3 or 4%, enough to push them over the top so they could win. You can't let terrorists out of Guantanamo. You know, the Republicans have done all these things or variations on them on ballots in order to get people to out to vote. And the Democrats, like I said, you know, they've kind of accidentally done this in a couple of states where it had nothing to do with the Democratic Party, but local activists here in Washington, D.C. Marijuana legalization is on the ballot starting this week. And frankly, it's one of the reasons I'm going to vote. I mean, the mayor's race in D.C., I got no senator. I got no member of the House of Representatives. I mean, Eleanor Holmes Norton is up for re-election, but she's going to win. She's very, very popular. But marijuana legalization's on the ballot, too. And it's so, you know, I think it's going to pass, but I would love to vote for that. So put things on the ballot that appeal to young people. Come on, Democrats. I mean, I realize it's too late to do it now. Speaking of too late to do it now, down in Georgia, this is amazing. In Georgia, there's this group in Georgia called the New Georgia Project. And they are committed to getting young people and people of color who have never voted before, registered to vote. And they got about 80,000, 90,000 people to register to vote. And they submitted them to the Secretary of State, who's a Republican, and said, here you go, 90,000 new voters. And the Secretary of State looks at that and goes, whoa. And decided, apparently, that those people in the heavily Democratic regions of Atlanta, Savannah, and Columbus, three cities with large African-American populations and heavy Democratic victories typically, 50,000 of those people in those three areas, the Democratic Secretary of State in Georgia just didn't bother to process the new voter registrations. So these people never got their voter ID card, their voter registration card in the mail. So they don't know where to go to vote. They don't know what precinct they're registered at. So if they show up to vote at the place nearest to them, they may be told, hey, you're not on the list. Or, well, actually, right now they'll be told you're not on the list because they're not registered. So the new Georgia Project complained to the Secretary of State and said, may we have a meeting with you? And the Secretary of State said, no, I will not meet with you. Not going to discuss it. So they've taken this to a judge. But it's kind of late. I mean, it's really too late because the cards haven't been mailed out to these people, voter registration cards, these 50,000 people. That's enough to swing an election. This is all about, you know, Michelle Nunn and Sonny Perdue or whatever his name is, David Perdue. And Mr. or Mrs. Johnson, one of the representatives or Ms. Johnson, of the New Georgia Project, said in 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, the same thing happened. They would register people, submit them to the Secretary of State, nothing happened. In 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, we were only able to know there were problems when it was too late, when people started showing up at the polls and they were not on the voter rolls and people had already been disenfranchised. They were already not able to vote. So now they're asking in advance, and guess what? Secretary of State in Georgia, oh, you registered a bunch of Democrats. Well, that's nice. I'll put them in this drawer here, and we'll look at them next year. Hopefully they're in the drawer. I mean, it might have been the circular filing cabinet, right? The trash can. Oh, and big corporations are losing money. What does this say about Republican
You're
policy?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Reaganomics has finally hit the cancer stage where it's starting to hurt Walmart and McDonald's. I'll tell you about that after the break, and we'll take your calls. Stick around. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Remarkable. Okay, trickle up. Aradani is posting. By the way, the piece about the Dems facing betrayal after accepting Republican concessions is the headline by Steve Bannon, and that's over on Rachel Maddow's blog, the Rachel Maddow Show, the Maddow blog. For those of you trying to track down some of these sources, this from Daily Kos, reposted over at Democratic Underground. These corporations, this is, he's calling it the revenge of trickle down, which is great. Amazon lost $544 million. Walmart cut its earnings guidance for a year, for the year after it posted its seventh straight quarterly decline in U.S. store traffic. McDonald's reported a larger than expected drop in profits Tuesday morning. Coca-Cola sales declined in the first two quarters of the year. The company's year-to-date revenue is down 2%. Net income for the quarter is down a whopping 14% from last year. What's going on? All these stores that cater to people on the low end of the economic ladder are having serious problems. Could it be that Reaganomics is finally taking hold? I mean, keep in mind, the end game of Reaganomics is not prosperity for all. That's how it was sold to us. The end game of Reaganomics is feudalism. It's oligarchy. It's a very small number of people get mind-bogglingly rich and everybody else gets screwed. And here's the problem. When everybody else gets screwed, those businesses that make their money by offering goods and services, cheap goods and services to the everybody else, no longer have customers. I mean, you know, Reaganomics put the screw to people, and for, you know, for a decade or so, people just kind of held their breath and got by. And this is the, you know, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, people put the money, you know, they borrowed against their home. Actually, in the 90s, people borrowed against their credit card. We saw this explosion of credit card debt, $1 trillion of the credit card debt. In the 2000s, during the early Bush years, the first eight Bush years, everybody was converting, using their home to pay off their credit cards and pay off their school loans. And now we've got, in just in the last 10 years, school loan debt in the United States has tripled. $1.24 trillion right now. So what's happened is students can't afford to buy anything anymore. Their parents can't afford to buy anything anymore. Working people who make, you know, less than $25,000, $30,000, even there, I mean, they can't afford to buy it. It just goes on and on and on, right? This theory that if you cut taxes on the very, very rich, if you take care of the top, it'll take care of the bottom, it wasn't even a theory. It was an excuse to cut taxes on rich people. And it's been totally disproven. And now you're seeing, I mean, the largest employer in America, Walmart, starting to go down. McDonald's, I mean, this is amazing. Walmart store cut its earnings guidance for the year after it's posted its seventh straight quarterly decline. Seventh straight quarterly decline. It's amazing. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
I just wanted to say, you know, I don't think we're really getting the truth about inflation, and particularly when it comes to commodities. And I think not even talking about the chain CPI, I agree with Bernie Sanders. You know, people were not getting a big enough cost of living raise to deal with the things that older people pay for, which is food, and then their property taxes and sales taxes have gone up because, you know, they've redistributed those taxes from, you know, giving income tax breaks to rich people. So we're ending up having to pay more for the schools, more for the infrastructure and things like that. But also commodity prices, I think there's some of them have gone up 50%. And the same people that were behind the banking problem, banking bubble are also behind this commodity bubble. Goldman Sachs is one. And it's been mentioned before on this program by other people, but I wondered if you could comment on that.
On what piece of it?
Well, in inflation. I think inflation, we're not getting an honest appraisal of what inflation actually is.
No, we're not. We need to have a CPI specifically for Social Security and retired veterans, because those are the people who this hits. And on that, Simpson and Bowles would agree, right? And the conservatives and all the Republicans, Social Security and retired veterans need to have their own CPI because they have a relatively unique standard of life compared to, you know, the average, you know, 40-year-old married worker with 1.2 kids or whatever it is. Their expenses tend not to be heavy on computer parts and to be heavy on things like food and medicine. And
I just wanted to say, you know, wages have not really increased very much to actually pay for what is what has gone, you know, increased in prices, the commodities.
No, well, that's where the middle class is screwed and why the middle class is going into home debt, credit card debt, and student loan debt. And a lot of the student loan debt is because mom and dad can't afford to pay for school anymore. A lot of it is because you got all these for-profit schools in the mix and a very, very aggressive predatory lending industry in the mix. But the net-net with regard to Social Security is we need to have a consumer price index, a CPI, that's unique to Social Security, but not a chained one, not one that says, oh, we're going to cut your benefits because you're eating chicken now or cat food instead of hamburger or steak. We need to have one that just reflects the actual cost, you know, increases in the cost of living. And it may be for retired people substantially higher than it is for everybody else, frankly.
Yeah.
So, John, thank you for the call. Well said. Scott in Chicago. Hey, Scott.
Yes. My point was that with Social Security, I would just like your comments on if we paid a percent of what you paid in. If you leave the rates the same and just pay, just receive benefits at the percent you paid in. So if you make $100,000, you'd get 100% of your benefits at retirement. If you made $1 million, you'd get 10% of your benefits. So you only paid 10% of your income.
I don't understand.
Okay.
Are you talking about means testing Social Security?
It would be a form of means testing, but it would be based on what you paid in.
Do you have life insurance,
so
Scott?
If you make $100,000 a year, Tom.
Scott, do you have life insurance?
What's that?
Do you have life insurance?
Do I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. How would you feel if, and the beneficiary is what? Wife, family, neighbor? Who's your beneficiary?
Wife and child.
Okay. So how would you feel if, and I realize it would be hard to feel when you're dead, but how would you feel if you died and your life insurance company said to your wife, you know, you have the ability to have a job that pays, you know, a fair amount of money, or you're making an okay money now, or this guy that you might be dating is a doctor and he's got a good income, so we're going to cut the payment to you in half because you don't really need all this money.
Well, I guess what I'm saying,
would you feel screwed?
Well, that's a private contract.
No, it's insurance. Social Security is not a retirement program. It's insurance. It is social insurance against poverty and old age. It's not a retirement program.
But if you can't get people to pay 100%, pay taxes on 100% of their income by paying into Social Security. Well, then have them pay in their, they pay in the percent of their income and decide that as your benefit. So if you're making $1 billion a year and you're only paying Social Security on 1% of your income,
right,
your benefit should be 1%.
So you're not talking about means testing as much as you're talking about people's Social Security benefits being a function of what they put into the Social Security system. And I would say, again, what we have is not a retirement plan. If you're talking 401ks, great. Although, by the way, I don't know if you've noticed, but something like 15 or 20% of all 401ks have been drawn down and taken out, which has incurred huge penalties for people. 401ks and IRAs are right on the verge of being a net loss for the middle class right now, in large part because of the horrific, you know, the Bush crash of 2007-2008. But the net effect of this is that, you know, if you're talking a retirement plan, fine. But Social Security is not a retirement plan. One-third of Social Security benefits don't even go to retired people. They go to people that literally widows, orphans, and disabled people. One-third of all Social Security payments. And how are you going to fund that? So it's not as simple as you think. Chris in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Chris. I got a minute.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Your idea about getting people to the polls, we need to do something. But your idea of like promising a big-ticket item like amnesty on loans, what would happen is the first thing your opponent would do is label you as a big spending liberal socialist.
You and
know?
You say, fine, that's what I am. I am here for students and their parents.
For the average person, Mr. Hartman, that isn't fine. The deficit means something to the average Joe. It does.
Yeah, it means the average. See, I'm betting that there's more average Joes who have student loans, who have kids who have student loans, who have brothers or sisters with student loans than there are average Joes who don't. And so, yeah, I mean, you'd have to find something like that. I think that that's probably the low-hanging fruit. I could be wrong on that. But you have to find something like that that affects a large enough number of people that they're going to say, yeah, sure. I mean, the whole Republican shtick about why democracy is a bad thing, why you need the Koch brothers and you know, plutocrats to basically tell you how to vote, their whole thing is because you can't trust people, average working people, because they'll vote for things for themselves. Well, they will. The problem is they'll do it reasonably.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's not even a problem. The reality is that they'll do it reasonably. You look at those states where people have voted a strong social safety net, they're actually doing better. New York, California, they're doing better. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Judy in Redlands, California. Hey, Judy, you want to talk about Jody Ernst?
Yes, I do, Tom. I'm a former resident of the Midwest. I lived in Western Illinois and spent a lot of time in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be an utter disgrace if this woman is placed in the seat that belonged to the great Tom Harkin. And I just hope Iowa voters will wake up and realize that she is just another Michelle Bachmann. And I know the race is really tight right now, but Iowa is not really a red state. It's a purple state.
The race is tight because billionaires are throwing millions of dollars into it. It's really all of these races are tight exclusively because billionaires are throwing hundreds of millions of dollars into these races. Go ahead.
I agree. There's too much of this big money in politics.
Yeah.
But this race particularly concerns me because I think that Senator Harkin was a great asset to his state and the country.
Right.
And I would hate to see this seat fall into the hands of a radical conservative.
Yeah, I agree with you. Jody Ernst is in favor of a personhood bill. So that if you are a woman and you become pregnant, you have to register yourself with the local police. If you have a miscarriage, you have to call the police to come over and inspect you to see if you induced that miscarriage or it was natural. Let's keep in mind 1 in 4 pregnancies ends in a miscarriage. That would make it illegal for pharmacists to sell birth control pills that have hormones in them because they prevent implantation. They can prevent a fertilized egg from implanting itself in the uterus, thus producing what these crazed right-wingers call an abortion. They would outlaw the IUD, same reason. And that's just one of Jody Ernst's. She says she carries a gun because she may need to use it against her government. It's just the woman is a whack job. And like I said, the only reason she's as high in the polls as she is because you've got a small number of very wealthy right-wing billionaires who want Republican control of the Senate, and they'll throw it to anybody. And Jody Ernst is you know, one of those fringe candidates who, they're trying to gussy up and say, oh, no, she's not a crazy person. Yeah, she is, actually. Marty in Monroe, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV. Marty, got just a minute till the break. It's a quick one.
Yeah. Great show, dude. Great show.
Thanks.
I'm a fan and admirer. But I'm on Social Security disability because I have a very, very rare genetic disease called alpha-1 antitrypsin.
Mm-hmm.
and I get a little less than $1,300 a month. Out of that comes, because I live in a garage, a friend's garage, I got to pay rent, utilities, food, and $500, almost $600 a month in medicine out of my pocket, not counting what Social Security and Medicare covers.
Wow.
And this 1.7%, what's that going to do for the 58 million people that's on Social Security?
Right. Virtually nothing, because it's not even keeping up with inflation. I well said, Marty. Thank you for the call. And thanks for reminding us that it's not just retired people. It's not just old people who get Social Security. A third of Social Security payments are going to people who are, in some cases, 3 years old. You know, literally widows, orphans, and disabled people. This is a social insurance policy. It's not a retirement policy. We'll be back. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There's going to be a White House briefing in a few minutes. We'll find out what that's all about and bring it to you live. Should it be of great consequence, tell you about it if it's not. Robert in Decoula, Georgia. Am I saying that right, Robert?
Yes, you are. Hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up? Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Hey, no problem. I love it. I caught the end of your early voting and some missing ballot story. When I got in my car, I voted within the hour, early voted. And what I was going to say is you made mention of some of those people being put into the system but not receiving their voter card in their polling places. Go early vote. It's until Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. You just have to be within your county. I'm in Gwinnett County. It's a large county. I went in, voted, no problem.
But you're already registered to vote.
Right, and what I'm saying is I'm making mention solely of the people you say might have gotten the system but hadn't.
They're not in the system. They're not in the system. According to the Secretary of State, he has not processed 40 to 50,000 of these 90,000 people, principally, it seems like maybe exclusively from these three largely Democratic cities.
Okay, so those are the ones that he said he wasn't sure were there, and then he didn't know anything about it, and then all of a sudden he didn't know about it.
Right. Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he's refusing to have a meeting about it. And
he's listening.
He's refusing to have a meeting about it, and they're suing about it, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So, but is it, you live in Georgia, is the window for registering to vote closed?
The window is closed. It's 30 days prior.
Yeah, okay. So that's the problem that they have. They show up to vote, and they're not registered. They have not, their registrations have not been processed. It's not just that they haven't gotten the cards. It's that their registrations have not been processed. And this has happened in the last five elections in Georgia, that the Republican Secretary of State takes the registrations from the largely Democratic counties and puts them through the system after the election instead of before the election, when there's this huge get out the vote effort before the election. And this
Wonderful.
Is, I mean, this, you know, welcome to James R. Crow ESQ. You know, this, they back, the, Jim Crow is a little more upfront and honest about what it was doing. This is the same thing, only different. Robert, thanks for the call. Andy in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. As you well know, there are millions of Americans that believe in this trickle-down theory that if you keep rich people happy, the rest of this will benefit. And what I wanted to ask you is what – it's hard to know why people do what they do, but – what do you think the appeal is of the lot of that kind of logic? That if you're taking billions and billions out of our economy, is what's happening. But how do you think that appealed to people? That trickle down theory that if you keep my boss happy, I'll have a job.
Right. I was around in the 80s when Reagan was selling this stuff. In fact, I remember the 1980 primary when Ronald Reagan was running against George Herbert Walker Bush. And George Herbert Walker Bush said, this is voodoo economics. This is the silliest thing I ever heard. And Ronald Reagan said, essentially, no. If you give everybody a tax cut, that's going to increase prosperity. And if we give tax cuts to the job creators, they will take that extra money that they get from the tax cuts and build new factories and create new jobs. And I think for a low information voter and for somebody who has never started or run a business and never been in an executive position in a business, that doesn't sound like an unreasonable sales pitch. They don't realize that businesses don't hire people or do hire people. You know, the businesses make hiring decisions based on demand, on what they need in order to sell their product, rather than based on revenue. They you know, if a company has a bunch of extra revenue, if they get a tax cut and they have an extra $10 million this year, they're not going to build an extra factory for it unless they got a red hot product. You know, Apple might be building a new factory right now for iPhones, but you know, the average company, and they're not doing it because they got a tax break. They're doing it because they rolled out a good product, or at least so far.
If you ask me, what I've found out here in the street is that what the reason that appeals to people is the opposite of that is what scares them. If I don't keep my boss happy, I'll lose my job.
Right.
If I don't lower taxes, reduce regulation, I'm screwed.
Right.
That's what I think so
right, and that's,
a lot of folks.
And that's, you know, there's a good motivation strategy has the, you know, this is kind of NLP 101. A good motivation strategy has two parts, moving toward pleasure and moving away from pain. In other words, it offers a promise, and a carrot and a stick. And the carrot and stick being offered here, and they do it very effectively. I mean, these guys come on my program all the time and pitch it. The carrot is, if we give the job creators tax breaks, they will create more jobs. The stick is, if we maintain high levels of regulation and taxation, these people are going to take their factories and move offshore. And, in fact, they're doing that right now. And but the simple fact of the matter is they're not doing it because of taxes and regulation. They're doing it because of labor costs and because the tax code encourages them to right now. And these are very specific changes in the tax code that have been made since the mid-'80s that encourage offshoring of jobs. And
taxes and regulations don't have anything to do with whether somebody gets hired for a job. It has to do with markets. If there is a market for a product, the boss will hire more people.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. It's called demand. A market and the word market and the word demand are pretty much interchangeable. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Andy, thank you for the call. Diana in Poinette, Wisconsin. Hey, Diana, thanks for listening to 92.1 FM. We have just a minute for the break.
Thanks for taking my call. What I wanted to touch down about is Social Security. People, there's so many people that don't even understand how it operates. I mean, if you don't pay in to Social Security, you don't get any. I mean,
right. Or you get very little, actually.
Well, yeah, very, very little. I mean, I have a friend who moved here from Canada about 15 years ago, so she doesn't have much paid in, and she's in her 60s, and she's not getting a whole heck of a lot of money.
Right.
But, and also another thing is, if you have a job and like the low-paying jobs they have now, the small amount of FICA that's going into Social Security for these people isn't going to amount to beans
right.
when they get retirement age. And there's so many people I talk to that think that Social Security is something other than it is. And they think that we're actually stealing from them and they're paying for us and all this.
I know. These are the sales pitches that the right wingers, the Dennis Pragers of the world have been pitching for a long time. Diana, thank you for the call. And we need to be waking people up about.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Derek Green, a member with Project 21, faculty member with Prager University. Yes, Dennis Prager, the right-wing talk show host. Derek's website, nationalcenter.org/p21index.html. You can find a link to it over at tomhartman.com. Derek, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You wrote an interesting op-ed, Who Are the Racists, Liberals, or Conservatives, for the National Center for Public Policy Research. Want to tell us about it?
Sure. It was a brief piece that I did. It was actually a video for Prager University, in which I try to attempt to dispel the myth that conservatives or conservative positions are racist. And so I brought up two issues of affirmative action and voter ID, and argued the conservative position regarding both of those issues to demonstrate that the issues in themselves aren't racist, even though they're construed that way. And so I was hoping that the op-ed and the video would allow people both on the political left and right to take a second look about these issues. I think that we can disagree about policy issues, I think sincerely, but I think that when you start to cast dispersions on people's character, it distorts the issues, and I think that robs a lot of people from making educated decisions on political issues.
You write, I argue against the slander of racism that the left directs at conservatives. It's a reflexive mantra to retain power. I would further suggest that liberals and leftists are actually more racist. They are preoccupied by race, and they constantly inject it where it shouldn't be. Are you aware where Ronald Reagan gave his very first speech when he was running for president after the Republican National Convention had awarded him the nomination in 1980?
No.
It was Philadelphia, Mississippi. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
And his speech was on states' rights.
Okay.
You could look it up. The Republican Party has a long history. Philadelphia, Mississippi, of course, the town where three civil rights workers were brutally murdered back in the 60s. The Republican Party and the conservative movement in general has a long history dating back to the Nixon era. Before that, it was the Democratic Party. They had a long history of this, of reaching out to white racists. How can you ignore that?
I don't think I'd necessarily ignore that. And I think the fact that you have to go back to 1980 proves my point. You see, Democrats have a very long history of racism as well, just like you mentioned. But I think that particular history is still going on to this current day. What are some recent issues that you would think that conservatives are racist? I mean, it's the Democrat Party who had a former Klansman in Congress up until 4 years ago.
You're talking about Robert Byrd?
Yes.
Yeah, who renounced the Klan.
But he was, again,
50 years ago he was in the Klan.
No, but he might have renounced the Klan, but he was still a member of the Klan, of the Ku Klux Klan. What member of the Republican Party or conservative? No. What member of the conservative or Republican Party was a former Klansman that was in Congress up until 4 years
ago? Well, that's my whole point. The racism of the Republican Party has gotten far more subtle. It's no longer Jim Crow. It's James Crow ESQ. But let's start at a baseline here, Derek Green.
Are you suggesting
that there is no such thing, as an African-American, are you suggesting that there's no such thing as white privilege?
No, I wouldn't say it that way. I think there's a certain privilege that comes along with being in the middle class. I think there's a certain privilege that comes along with embracing the values that make the middle class what it is. So I don't necessarily think it's white privilege. I think there's blacks, Asians, Latinos who are also in the middle class who also engage in whatever privilege that you want to say attributing to white people. But again, what is white privilege? It's just a euphemism. It can mean whatever one wants it to mean. It's like hope and change.
Well, I can tell you what white privilege is for me.
Ask by people what hope and change mean, you're going to get five different answers.
I can tell you what white privilege is for me as a white guy. White privilege is that I never wonder if I don't get the seat I want in a restaurant if it was because of my race. I never wonder if I don't get the that I wanted if it's because of my race. I never wonder if somebody says, sorry, that apartment was just rented, if it's because of my race. I don't wonder if somebody walks on the other side of the street if it's because of my race. I could go on. I mean, I live in a multiracial city here in Washington D.C. and I see very clearly I don't wonder if a taxi driver doesn't pick me up if it's because of my race. Those are the subtle small insults of racism that are still alive and well in this country, and you as an African-American must know this, that constitute white privilege or whatever the opposite of that is for blacks.
Well, I disagree with your premise, because a lot of those issues that you just said that's attributed to white privilege, I also engage in. I don't think that people don't pick me up or walk on the other side of the street because of my race. If you want to talk about a taxi cab or walking on the other side of the street because of my race, I think that more has to do with a criminal profile than a racial one. But again, let me go back to what you said earlier.
So you're saying black people are more likely to be criminals?
You say that conservative racism, Republican racism, you take it as a truthism. Give me an example of the racism that you're talking about. What conservative racism, what racism in the Republican Party that you're so sure exists, give me an example of that. Give me two examples. Give me three examples.
Well, I'll give you one really simple one. If you look at one of the most Republican states in the nation, North Dakota, it is also one of the whitest states in the nation. It has one of the lowest proportions of people of color of any state. North Dakota also has voting laws that are the least restrictive in the entire United States. You can register to vote on the day you vote. You don't need to show ID. You just show up. But it's all white people. If you graph the states where Republicans, exclusively Republicans, have introduced voter suppression ID laws, what you will find is that the number of attempts and the success of the attempts to impose voter suppression ID laws increases as a direct function. In other words, you can chart this on a graph as a direct function of the black population in those states. The more African Americans there are in a state, the more likely the Republicans are to introduce voter suppression ID laws. The fewer African Americans there are, no ID laws. Hey, you know, it's North Dakota, it's Wyoming, it's Oklahoma. We got no African Americans here. We don't need no stinking, voter suppression law. There's one for you.
Okay, so that's racist. So requiring a person to show an ID to vote is racist.
Because 6% of white adults in the United States do not of voting eligibility do not have appropriate ID, and the majority of them are either disabled or elderly. And 24% of African Americans in the United States do not have the kinds of ID that would be necessary to vote in Texas. In Texas, if you're a veteran, you can't vote using your military ID because the military is heavily integrated. You can vote, however, if you have a concealed weapons permit, which is well over 90% white people in the state of Texas. So, yeah, absolutely.
I think that's correlation with no causation. I think that to require an ID to vote isn't racist. It's just a simple measure to
It is racist when 24% of the black population does not have this ID because people live in cities and they don't need driver's licenses, they don't own cars.
Well, wait a second.
It's absolutely racist.
Wait. In your daily life, as I said in the Prager University video, you need an ID for an assortment of things. So to say
such as what?
Require those to buy alcohol. To rent a hotel room, to open up a checking
account. Not necessarily true. No, you can open a checking account without a photo ID. You can fly on an airplane without a photo ID. You can pick up prescriptions without a photo ID.
No, you can't.
Yes, you can. You absolutely can. Go on the TSA's website.
You actually have to use an ID in some instances.
Not the kind of ID that you have to use to vote.
So again, to require ID on a day-by-day basis for an assortment of issues isn't racist.
Derek, I can't believe you're using these weasel words. You understand what I'm saying, don't you? In order to get on an airplane, yeah, you've got to show some kind of ID. It can be
Is that racist?
It doesn't have to have your picture on it.
Tom, is it racist?
The Texas ID that you need to vote is more restrictive than what you need to get on an airplane. Yes, that's racist.
Absolutely. Get on an airplane?
It is absolutely. Absolutely.
On an airplane.
Wow. Oh, no, of course not. Okay, Derek, great little gotcha, but hold on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Derek Green, member of Project 21, NationalCenter.org. Check it out. We'll be back. I am getting increasingly intolerant of people who pitch bullcrap because they're paid to. And, I can't speak specifically to Daryl, but I know the organization is all about this. Quint in Columbus, Nebraska, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Quint, what's up? You wanted to talk about Social Security?
Yes, I called in. It was about 20 years ago. A friend of mine was sitting here as an attorney, and he said that the government had been borrowing out of Social Security for a lot of years. Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this. And now with all the baby boomers coming in, the chickens have come home to roost. And that's about what I got to say.
The first half of what he said was true, and the second half is a lie. If you know what a federal bond is, what a savings bond is?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So if you were to go out and buy a $1,000 savings bond for your own retirement, or a $100 savings bond to, you know, give to one of your kids as a birthday present, because you can buy these things with a 20-year maturity for about $30, you know. If you were to, my dad used to give me one every year, a $100 savings bond. If you did that, have you, A, invested in the United States, or B, has the government borrowed money from you?
I you could correct me, because this was, like I said, about 20 years ago, and he just act like he didn't want to pay back.
Right, but to the question. I mean, set aside Social Security for a minute. If you buy a savings bond from the Treasury Department, you can buy them through your bank. You buy a Treasury Department a bond, which says that 20 years from now the government will give you $100. You buy it right now for $25. In other words, it's got the interest built into the next 20 years. And the question is, did you just loan your government $25 and they're going to pay you back $100, you know, the $25 with interest, or over a 20-year period, or did you just invest in your, you know, make an investment, a $25 investment that's going to pay a $100 return over 20 years? The answer is both. What Social Security has done is they starting in 1981, what pretty much everybody saw, including Ronald Reagan, although it was Tip O'Neill and Alan Greenspan who were in charge of, Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Alan Greenspan who were in charge of the commission in 1981. That Reagan put together. What they saw was that starting around the year 2000 or 2005, that as the baby boomers started to age out, there'd be too many people drawing on Social Security and not enough people paying into it. So what they did is they said one generation, the boomers, are going to be double taxed. They're not only going to use their Social Security money to pay for their parents' retirement, which is how it had worked prior to 1981, but half of their Social Security money is going to pay for their parents' retirement. The other half is going to go into a savings fund, a Social Security trust fund, which they will then draw down from 2005 to 2040. Okay? And they will be double taxed. They will literally pay for their own retirement as well as their parents. And Reagan doubled the Social Security tax in 81 in order to pay for that. And that fund now has $2.1 trillion in it. That money is invested in the safest investment in the world, which is U.S. Treasury bonds. And they're already actually starting to pay out of that fund as they're supposed to. And in order to do that, they're turning these bonds in and saying, give us the cash. Now, that's the safest investment that there is. People all over the world are putting their money in U.S. Treasury bonds. Social Security did, too. And so it didn't crash when the market crashed and all those other things. But the fact of the matter is that a bond is also a debt. So arguably, the government is borrowing from us. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Arvin here with you. Somebody just called and said, my friends are saying that Social Security is going to go away because, you've got, you know, three, in the next 10 years or so, you're going to have three wage earners for every employee, whereas in 1930 it was like 30. And, you know, there's not enough money coming in to pay for what's going out. Yes. Oh, and they say, Social Security has been borrowing money from the federal government since the 1980s. Okay, here's what's going on. In 1981, the Social Security actuaries looked out and they said, you know, there's this rabbit moving through the python. Right, this is apropos of the Democrats who are calling for a chain CPI, and now the Republicans are attacking them for wanting to cut Social Security, even though the chain CPI is a Republican thing. So anyhow, back in 81, the Social Security Administration said, when the boomers start to retire, in 2000, 2005, 2010, as the baby boomers start to retire, it's a very large population because after World War II, everybody came back and had babies, right? As the baby boomers start to retire, there's not going to be enough money in Social Security to pay for their retirement. Because the way Social Security had been working up until 1981 was every dollar that you paid into Social Security went to pay for some retired person's, or a disabled person's cost of living. And so what they did, I mean, Reagan did some nasty things. Like he said, okay, let's change it so Social Security benefits are, you pay income tax on them. That was obscene. But Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Alan Greenspan put together this commission, and they said, okay, let's create a $2 trillion trust fund to pay for the retirement of these boomers. Where are we going to get that money from? We will ask the boomers to pay for their own retirement in addition to the retirement of their parents. So starting in 1982, Reagan doubled the payroll tax. And I'm not sure if my dad was even retired by 1982, but what it meant was that I started in 1982 not only paying into my dad's retirement and everybody else's retirement, but into my own also, into a savings account for my own as a boomer. And there is now this $2.4 trillion savings account called the Social Security Trust Fund that all the hedge fund managers on Wall Street are salivating over. This is why Pete Peterson has spent hundreds of millions of dollars, a Wall Street hedge fund manager or bankster. It's why these guys are trying to promote these lies about Social Security. They want that $2 trillion. It's just sitting there, invested in treasuries. So now these lying conservative scum come along and they say, well, you know, the Social Security money is borrowed by our government. The government has borrowed all $2.4 trillion of it. Well, sort of. I mean, this proves that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. The fact of the matter is that if the federal government had, it's got to invest that money, right? It's sitting on $2 trillion. It's got to invest it someplace. If they invested it in bonds for General Motors, they'd be loaning the money to General Motors. If they invested it in bonds for IBM, they'd be loaning it to IBM. When you buy federal bonds, yeah, you're arguably loaning money to the federal government, and the government will pay it back with interest, but it's the safest investment on earth. They're having no problem selling treasuries. They're selling, the interest rate is under 2% right now. Why? Because it's the safest investment on earth. So Social Security, the Social Security Trust Fund, first of all, the boomers are paying double. They're paying for their retirement and their parents' retirement. And that will end in 2040. Secondly, the Social Security Trust Fund is invested in U.S. treasuries. Yeah, you could say that that money's been borrowed to the federal loaned to the federal government. The federal government has spent it. But the federal government will pay it back. People are turning in bonds constantly, and they're getting their money back out. And the Social Security Trust Fund is starting to. So this is just a simple lie by the people who want to get their hands on that $2 trillion. And you will find these lies embedded in our media constantly. You will see this stuff. You know, Joe Scarborough talks about this kind of stuff. Right-wing talk radio talks about this kind of stuff. Even NPR, I've heard these lies on. They're just simple lies, number one. Number two, our guest from the National Center for Public Policy Research, this right-wing think tank that runs this Project 21 Black Leadership Network, where if you're African-American and you're willing to take a conservative position, you can get a pretty good paycheck. Derek Green was just with us. And at the very end of our debate, as it were, he was saying, he was asking me if I think that having to have an ID to get on an airplane is racist. Obviously, a stupid question. I don't think that. I misunderstood his question. Just for the record. It's sad that, I find it personally sad, that serious issues like this, where the Republican Party is aggressively and fairly nakedly trying to suppress the vote of African Americans, that you would have a think tank out there that is hiring African Americans to do media and assert that that's not the case. I just find that somewhere between tragic and bizarre. I'm not questioning Derek Green's motives. He may well believe this. He may well believe that, the white people in the Republican Party, they just love black people. And they think that everybody should have equal opportunity. Even though Jamie Dimon, just came out and said, quote, this is in an interview with CNBC, it is the norm for business for years for banks to hire the sons and daughters of the company's employees and give them proper jobs without violating the law. So we got to figure out exactly how to create a safe harbor so that you don't end up getting punished for this. In other words, white banksters hiring their family. It's the old boy network. How do people of color break into that? It's the same thing with some of our major universities. You know, how did George W. Bush get into Yale? His daddy went there. It was affirmative action for rich people, for rich white people. To say that there is no racism in the Republican Party is shockingly laughable. Anyhow, if you have a suggestion or an example, give me a shout.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your calls right after this. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Time for our pigeon alert for the day. Da-da-da.
Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
No, it's a plane.
We are autonomous robotic organisms from the planet Xenu.
And now, a story about a bird.
Right, the people in Warminster, UK, England, are starting to get worried. Is this like the place we've always wondered, you know, the pigeons being these robotic spies from the planet Xenu sent here to watch us wherever there's meetings of powerful, important people. You have lots of pigeons, right? And you never see baby pigeons or dead pigeons. They're robots. And so the question is, when the planet Xenu spaceships come and they drop off a new load of pigeons and pick up the old ones so they can play back their tapes or download their chips, where do they do that? Maybe it's Warminster, UK. The population is doubling, says the says Councillor Batchelor of the City Council. And also he runs Batchelor's Cycles in Marketplace. And he says lots of businesses and residents are concerned about this. Too many pigeons. What are we going to do? They're voting on November 3rd about whether to appropriate money to put signs out warning people about the pigeons. I can see it now. Warning! Robots from the planet Xenu. Yeah. Anyway. Dan in Great Lakes, Illinois. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Once again, God bless you for the work it is that you do.
Thank you.
Two things real fast, Tom. To the caller, the conservative you were speaking to, I would only say to him, 60 Minutes did a survey or a study on one of its shows where they followed, they had two people who showed up at like a retail store. One person was black, one was white. They followed the black man around the store while the white man robbed the store of thousands of dollars in merchandise. I'm a black man. I go to Walmart every other week when I get my check to pick up my incidentals. And I've been going there for 5 years. From the time I enter that store till the time that I leave, I am followed around. Yet there's another guy who they hired by the name of Dan to work there. He wasn't there 6 weeks before he stole $10,000 in cash from the store. This is what I live with as an African-American male every day of my life. Yeah. That and the other thing I'd like to say, Tom.
Well, Dan, if I may, before you move on, in defense of my guest, Derek Green, he was asking me to point to specific examples of racism in the Republican Party. And what I was saying is it's subtle enough that I can't say, other than the voter suppression laws, which I think are fairly naked racism. Beyond that, it's subtle enough, and he's denying that that's racist. It's subtle enough that all the racists get it, but you can't say, that's it. Unless you know of some Republican Party policies that specifically hurt people of color.
Oh, that is not what I was attempting to say. What I am saying is, Tom, is that there is a faction within the Republican Party that is racist.
period.
Yeah.
And their racism is not even hidden any longer. I only gave examples of black people, white people, how things affect black people in a different way
right.
in this world.
Yeah, you're giving examples of white privilege, basically.
Absolutely. And when you start talking about voting and voter suppression and voters' rights and all this, it can't be rampant and non-existent at the same time. This is a game that they're playing to suppress votes so that they can win elections, because they cannot win elections on the issues. And that is in our face. It is not anything other than what it is. And they attempt to disguise it in the name of politics. And that's a game that they play. But that's okay. That's the point that I was attempting to make as it related to the caller you were speaking to.
Okay, well made. Now, but you wanted to talk about trickle-down economics.
Trickle down. David Stockman, Reagan's own budget director, came out several years ago to say that trickle down was hokum.
He said it on this program.
Oh, did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, we've had him on as a guest several times. And, you know, he told the story about how when it was first proposed, he said, this doesn't make any sense to me. And they said, get with the program. And so he got with the program and he pitched it and he felt very uncomfortable about it. But he thought, hey, maybe they're right. And it turned out they were tragically wrong, and he said, I told you so, and they basically drummed him out of the Republican Party. He wrote a book about it.
Will Bunch wrote a book about Reagan. It was called Tear Down This Myth.
Right.
I thought it was a very good book.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
But when we talk about David Stockman and the Reagan administration, it's the only arrow remaining in their quiver is to distort the reality of the past. And unfortunately, it's a past that was created largely by them. And I would cite banking deregulation, mammoth tax loopholes and reductions for wealthy individuals and corporations. And at the same time, the introduction of borrowing on a scale the likes of which we, or at least my generation, I'm a 50-year-old male, had never seen before. To attempt to debate anything to the contrary is not a debate at all. It is simply a lie.
Yeah.
This is what they, Republicans, have been reduced to, and that is to say conjecture, sleight of hand, outright blaming someone else for what is, in my opinion, crimes that they created. It is literally a childish game that they play. I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say bounces off of me and sticks to you. But as fate, and in my opinion, divine providence would have it, their guy, a Republican, George W. Bush, under their policies, largely their policies, Republican parties, presided over the largest economic catastrophe in the history of the world. This is not to be mistaken. It is a mess that they made.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And with regard to race in the Republican Party, I think Lee Atwater, the fellow who helped make Reagan president and Bush senior president, really, and who was behind the Willie Horton ads, a major Republican propagandist, as it were, He came right out and said it. This was maybe 20 years ago. He's dead now. He died of brain cancer. But he said basically, you know, Republicans back in the era of Nixon, they used to use the N-word. And then they figured out that they could talk about busing and they could replace the N-word with that. And then but now white people have gotten sufficiently sophisticated about understanding Republican code that all you have to do is say tax cuts and everybody understands that we're talking about things that, you know, that or welfare. Well, actually, let me let Lee Atwater say it. We've beeped out the N-words here, so whenever you hear beep, that's one of them. But here he is.
You start out in 1954 by saying by 1968, you can't say that hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like force busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you get it so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than white. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing. And a hell of a lot more abstract than, you know. So any way you look at it, race is coming on the back burner.
Yeah, so this is Lee Atwater saying, you know, we don't need to say even busing anymore. We can just say, you know, we need to dial back. We need a welfare reform. And everybody immediately interprets that as a racial code. Make sense, Dan?
You know, Tom, I know that it does. And for a Republican, I will not refer to your guest as a hack. But for these people who are hacks, who simply do the bidding of the Republican Party, who are African-American, it is difficult for me as an African-American male to consider the idea that you have any time on this planet, in this country, and to think that this version of the Republican Party does not do those things that negatively affect African-Americans. It's Stockholm syndrome, at least in my observation. You begin to sympathize with your captors.
Yeah.
You begin to feel empathy for the people who are doing you wrong. That is my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. Dan, thank you for calling and sharing that. Marlon in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Marlon, you have examples of racism in the Republican Party?
Sure. A couple of specifics, and you know, your guest can speak to them if he likes. First one was the recent interview done with a Republican strategist, might have even been Reince Priebus, but I think it was one of the strategists where they were discussing voter suppression, and he said, quote, this will help keep the lazy blacks at home.
Wow.
So you can go grab that. I know it's out there. I heard it.
Hmm.
And so that's a pretty specific example.
Yeah. I would think that if a person of any consequence had said that, it would be all over the place. But I'll have to look it up. Marlon, thank you for the call. Say what?
No, hold on. There was a second one.
Okay.
The second one was when the Tea Party was in its inception, or at least first coming to the national consciousness, it was pretty standard to have people in blackface and pictures of the president with targets on it, people walking around with machine guns and whatnot at these rallies. And these rallies were attended by Republican people of consequence, as you refer to them, on a regular basis. And there was no calling out of these people. They lobbied for these people's votes along with everyone else.
Yeah, I got it. Marlon, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour. Jamie Dimon, we've got to create a safe harbor where we don't get prosecuted. And welcome back. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And thank you for trying to teach people about Social Security. I do appreciate that.
You're welcome. It's amazing how many people have no understanding of the history of Social Security. And that's what these guys who are, you know, these hustlers who are trying to get their hands on that $2 trillion are depending on.
Yes, and these are the same people who don't pay taxes past that first $118,000 either.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But what I wanted to tell you was that if you don't mind, please, when you're talking about voting, there are so many people who say they're sick of politics. They're not going to go vote. I ask them, have you read your ballot? And they look at me funny. I say, our ballot here in Alabama has 4 amendments on it. Are you happy with these amendments? Do you know anything about them? Are the changes going to be good or the changes going to be bad? One of them affects future education funding.
Hmm.
And they look at me like they didn't know this. I said, you can pull your ballot up on the internet. You can pull your districts up on the internet. You can find out which district you live in. Most people don't know. They don't know for city council, county commission, local, or U.S. districts.
Right.
So you can go look and you can go see if there's someone running that would be better or worse and make up your mind. But the thing is, a lot of people who are sick of politics, they're going to miss the fact that their ballot in their state could have amendments on them. And these amendments will affect the way you live down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about going to vote, would you please ask people to go read their ballot, whether they like the people who are running or not?
I will do that. Norma, thank you very much for the call. It's an excellent suggestion. Anne, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Pompano Park, Florida. Hey, Anne, what's up?
It's Pomona Park.
Pomona, thank you.
No problem. You know, I
really love your show, and where else are you going to see a white man trying to convince an African-American that there is such a thing as racism going on? It's just, it's amazing to me. But I wanted to talk about, because someone had shared this morning a post with me from Right Wing News, I didn't even know they claimed to be, but it said, you know, they were tired of people pulling out the race card, as if they don't understand it's a card you can pull out, but you can never put back in. People can see your race all over the world. You know, like the gentleman that was calling before saying how he would just like to walk to the store as a human being, but that's not really possible. Right. I just think the whole language that even frames the debate is so racist, as in black-on-black crime. And I've even had somebody say to me, if you can imagine this, well, cops shoot white people too, so right. that would make it okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what? I mean, why can't they see? And you're right, it's because it's so prevalent, and we see it every day that we don't see it anymore, right down to, you know, all the black people are the ones on the welfare and draining our country. It's not our military. It just goes from everything. The denial is really just amazing to me, and to see it from a black man who I know and you know have experienced it is just, it's so stunning to me.
Yeah, well, and let me take it even a step beyond that, Ann. Can you imagine if John Lewis's family, if, you know, African-American congressman from Georgia, if John Lewis and his family had gotten in a brawl in a neighbor's front yard and the police had to be called and all this kind of stuff and a bunch of people got beat up, people would be talking about what's with this black culture. Nobody's asking the question with regard to the brawl that Sarah Palin's family had. What's with this white culture? These white people gone wild. It's just bizarre. And thank you for the call. Thank you so much for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. Hey, let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service and find out what's going on in the world. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. And I see Victoria Jones is in the Talk Radio News luxury suite in the basement of the White House. Hey, Victoria.
I sure am.
So, what's up?
Before
you slip into the hot tub there and enjoy the peeled grapes and champagne.
It's so luxurious.
It really is, yeah.
It's just wonderful. A report out tomorrow by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ahmad Shaheed, paints a dire picture of human rights in that country. 852 people have been executed since last year. He was shocked, he said, by the hanging over the weekend of 26-year-old Rehani Jabari, who was convicted of murdering a former intelligence officer who she claimed had tried to sexually assault her. And one person, he said, was executed for making a donation to a foreign organization. Some of the people who have been executed, 8 of them were juveniles. In addition, the situation of religion in the country for minority religions is really dire. 49 Christians are in prison merely for practicing their religion, things like holding informal house church services, and 120 Baha'is are in prison merely for being Baha'is. The state of freedom of belief in Iran is not improving. It is deteriorating. Dwight Bashir, Deputy Director of Policy and Research at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, said.
This is not good. How does this compare to Saudi Arabia?
I think that it is probably similar. Maybe... I don't know. It may be similar, if not worse in some ways, maybe better in other ways.
Iran has a much larger population.
It has a larger population. I think the reason it is particularly disturbing is that Hassan Rouhani was elected as a reformer.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is he a reformer? Mayor Javed Anfar, an Iranian Israeli Middle East analyst, says Rouhani should not have made promises. He is not a reformist.
Interesting. The fact of the matter is the prime minister doesn't have a whole lot of power, and given the Iran
right. and,
Iranian political
system.
The
fact of the matter
system.
Is that that he's close to, he is in fact a mullah.
Yeah.
And, you know, he is a Shia cleric.
Rouhani?
Yeah, he's a cleric.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he has very little interest in protecting the rights of religious minorities.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate.
Very unfortunate.
What else is up?
Meanwhile, very interesting development on the Ebola front regarding the Pentagon. And I just came from the White House briefing, which is going on as we speak with Josh Earnest, the press secretary. The Pentagon wouldn't say on Sunday whether it's willing to still send an active duty military Ebola response team to states ordering mandatory quarantine for Ebola healthcare workers. Now, the 30-person team that's going to Liberia finishes training today and will then be ready for deployment on 72 hours' notice. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel would have to approve any deployment. Josh Earnest just would not be drawn today on questions about this issue, kept referring people to the Department of Defense. And when he was repeatedly asked, well, what is the president's view of this, he just simply would not give it. Well, the president is the commander-in-chief, reporters asked. Well, nevertheless, he referred them to the Department of Defense as to whether they were, in fact, going to be going through quarantine or not. CNN learned today from multiple military officials that an army major general who is commander of U.S. Army Africa and approximately 10 other personnel are now in controlled monitoring Italy after landing there following a West Africa trip. Apparently, Italian authorities met them in full CDC gear. And although there's no indication that any team members have the virus. President Obama is expanding his push for increased manufacturing in the United States and will unveil executive action on that this afternoon. He's going to direct federal money toward new technologies, apprenticeship programs, and competitions designed to assist small manufacturers. The measures would allow the Pentagon, NASA, and Energy and Agriculture Departments to collectively spend $300 million to develop advanced materials and new technology for sensors and digital manufacturing, direct $100 million in Labor Department funds for apprenticeship programs aimed at advanced manufacturing, and author the Commerce Department to spend $150 million over 5 years in 10 states to help manufacturers adopt and market new technologies.
So we're going to develop advanced technologies on the taxpayer's dime, but we're not going to put anything into place to prevent those technologies from being fully exploited in China or Vietnam.
Doesn't mention anything about that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we invented the transistor. We invented the integrated circuit. We invented all these things, and we used to have tariff policies that kept manufacturing here in the United States. And not so much since 1996. Anyway, back to you.
Representatives Carolyn Maloney, Democrat of New York, and Leonard Lance, Republican of New Jersey, are urging Congress to pass their legislation, now written, to end federal benefits for people the government has identified as suspected Nazi war criminals. Now, this is going to be introduced when Congress reconvenes in November.
To end the investigation of Nazi war crimes?
To end the federal benefits.
Oh, end federal benefits. Okay, got it.
They're getting Social Security.
Right, right. I think maybe it's never too late for that argument. Okay, very interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great one. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And, hey, if you live in New York City, an evening with Harry Shearer, Nixon's the One. It's going to be Wednesday of this week at the on the 29th at the Slipper Room, which is 1167 Orchard Street, New York City. And it's at 8 p.m. The doors open at 7. If you go to slipperroom.com, you can get information on the tickets and the information. And speaking of Harry Shearer, he's on the line with us. Harry, welcome back to the program.
How does this happen, Tom?
At harryshearer.com, his website, modern-day Renaissance man, comic personality, multiple voices on The Simpsons. And it's been a while since we've talked, Harry. It seems like it's been a year or more.
At least.
Thank you for joining us. So tell us about this Nixon's the One. You're playing Richard Nixon?
Yes, I'm playing Richard Nixon, and Nixon loses. I was obsessed with Nixon growing up because I grew up in Southern California, so he was always around. And then, of course, when it became known that he had taped virtually his every waking word for 5.5 years, I was one of the people who flocked to the little warehouse outside D.C. to start listening to those tapes. And over the years, you know, as they released more and more of them, they got past the Watergate stuff and they got past the stuff that was involved in criminal trials or in hearings. And they started releasing tapes that had more and more of these just bizarre and wacky conversations. And so I called a friend of mine who's the leading American historian on the tape, Stanley Cutler. He's the guy who actually filed the lawsuit to make the tapes public in the first place on the weird grounds that we had paid for the tapes and paid for the tape recorders, so we owned the tapes. And I said, let's do a TV series about just those bizarre, grotesque, strange, unwittingly funny conversations.
Wow.
And so we did a 6-part series, which aired on British TV earlier this year, to what I hear were good reviews. And now it's just premiering on YouTube, free for everybody. We're releasing an episode a week. And so we're just at the beginning of the series right now.
That is absolutely great. My favorite Nixon story precedes his presidency. It has to do with the campaign of 1968.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that in August of 1968, LBJ had actually negotiated peace with between the North and South Vietnamese.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were going to nail it down in October.
Yep.
And Richard Nixon found out about this and blew it up. He went to the South Vietnamese and said, we'll give you a better deal. In fact, this we got from the Johnson Library. I've got a 20-second, 25-second clip here for you. This is LBJ talking to Everett Dirksen, the head of the Senate Republicans, saying, we've got a candidate for president. I don't want to get this in the press because the American people will be horrified, but we got a candidate for president committing treason.
Yep.
Here it is, Harry.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
And that wasn't released until 3 years ago.
Yeah, the reason that the BBC ran a whole show on that tape and the succeeding tapes, the next tape they had was of LBJ calling Hoover and saying, I want you to bug Nixon.
Right.
The reason that LBJ did not want to make any of that public is because it would have revealed that the United States was bugging the South Vietnamese embassy. That's how he knew. When he says, I'm very well informed, that's what he meant.
So that's how he was finding. I knew he was finding it out through the CIA. I didn't realize it was specifically through the South Vietnamese embassy.
Yeah, they were bugging the South Vietnamese embassy.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about the LBJ, of course, as is obvious from that excerpt, was recording. The difference between him and Nixon is LBJ hit the record button when he wanted to keep a conversation, when he wanted to record a conversation. Nixon was such a technophobe, they didn't trust him to find or hit the record button properly, so it was voice activated.
Mm.
So this is the only presidency of which every waking word was captured, and that's what made it possible to get all this bizarre stuff, because no president in his right mind would have hit the record button on a lot of these conversations.
Right. What are your favorite pieces of it?
Well, there's a conversation in episode 2, which is all about the very, very strange relationship between Nixon and Henry Kissinger. They're like two spiders in a bottle, trapped in a bottle. the question you see being played out as they talk to each other is who's using whom. But there's one scene where it's late at night. It's about 10:30 or 11 at night, and Kissinger is reporting to Nixon again in his usual obsequious style. Kissinger's way of dealing with the fact that he knew Nixon hated Harvard professors and hated Jews, and Kissinger was both, was to be incredibly obsequious. So he's saying, you know, this speech was great and it was the best speech ever. But Nixon, it's 10:30 or 11 at night, and Nixon has been drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the rare opportunities to hear that Nixon come through. So that's one of my favorites. And then the other one is the very last scene in the last episode. It's the 8 minutes just before Nixon delivers his resignation speech, which I'd always thought was just goofy. It had been bouncing around as a videotape because the CBS engineer had hit the record button when Nixon walked into the Oval Office. And he's joking around with the crew, and it's just the last thing you'd think he would do. He had no gift for small talk, and this is the moment before his maximum humiliation. And while we were rehearsing the show, and I should say we shot it as if he had hidden cameras in the White House as well as microphones, so it looks very weird and almost like hidden camera stuff. While we were rehearsing it, it suddenly occurred to me what that scene was about. He wasn't going to experience his humiliation. He was already planning his next campaign, which was the campaign for the rehabilitation of his reputation. He was thinking that the guys on the crew were going to walk out of there saying, he wasn't mad, he wasn't upset, he wasn't depressed, he was telling us jokes.
Right. He
was already running the next campaign.
Yeah, I mean, he'd already been through this in his attempt to run for president back in, what was it, 56, the Checkers speech?
It's 52, yeah.
52.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he'd already been through that, you know, losing, being humiliated, being accused of malfeasance, you know,
yeah.
taking that coat for Pat.
Yeah.
So that makes perfect sense.
A good Republican cloth coat, as he called it.
Yes, yes. That's what she has. Yeah, along with this dog that we got. Yes.
Not those minks that the Democrats were getting.
Right, exactly. Amazing. We're talking with Harry Scherer. He's got a show coming up. Lost my piece. Oh, here it is, right here. Which is An Evening with Harry Scherer. Nixon's the One. It's going to be Wednesday night at the Slipper Room in New York City on Orchard Street at 8 p.m. Doors open at 7. Slipperroom.com for information on this. And you said you're moving this, you're pushing this out to YouTube as well. Where is that, Harry?
This is on YouTube. The personal appearance is me basically talking about Nixon, my relationship, vicarious as it is with Nixon, and showing some highlights and clips from the series, and then doing a question and answer where I'll be doing the answers, strangely enough.
Yeah.
But the series is on YouTube. All you have to do is go to YouTube.com and type in Nixon's the One, Harry Scherer, and you should get each episode as it premieres, and then all the episodes that have already screened.
That's great. We have about 45 seconds. If I was to ask Richard Nixon today what his thoughts were about the political landscape, what might he say?
You could say what you want about my foreign policy. My domestic policy was so far to the left of this guy you got in there now, it'd make your damn head spin.
Wow.
True story. He started under him, OSHA and the EPA were started. The Clean Water and Clean Air Act were passed. He even delivered a speech late in his second term, calling for a guaranteed annual income for all Americans. He didn't do anything about it, but he made that speech.
Really?
Imagine how many wild horses it would take to get the current president to do that.
A guaranteed annual income. Did he specify any particulars?
No, I don't know. I haven't seen the speech lately, but it was a speech he seriously delivered, was advocating it for at least one moment in time.
I have got to look that up. Harry Shearer, you are a genius, my friend. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
HarryShearer.com also. You can find more information about that. And if you're in New York City this Wednesday, check out the Slipper Room, slipperroom.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be back 15 minutes past the hour with more of the news of the day, your calls, and my take on both. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom watching Tom watching Free Speech TV in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom, Professor Tom. Yes, hey, I do appreciate your patience with those talking heads digging their own graves for I don't know how much money. but it occurred to me that these Social Security lies and whatnot, we need an Ike moment. What is holding it back? And
what's an Ike moment?
Where he calls out, you know, the truth, as you professed before in the past. I'm a little bit nervous talking on the phone, forgive me.
Square.
I'm about an hour behind here. But I'm thinking in regards to the take the money and run, so to speak.
Right.
All this money and all this and which way the... Who represents who? The corporations, the military, industrial, or the people?
Right.
And what's stopping a lawsuit or a Smedley Butler scenario?
Yeah, for people who don't know what you're talking about, Smedley Butler back in the 30s was recruited by a group of Wall Street and big New York industrialists to lead a 600,000-man army, which they had already essentially raised, to march on Washington, D.C. and evict Franklin Roosevelt from the White House and install a new right-winger of their choice, basically a coup. And Smedley Butler was, at the time, the most famous retired Marine general in history, and he blew the whistle on these guys, and then he later went on to write a book called War is a Racket, in which he really called out the U.S. foreign policy. You know, there have been a couple of, you know, Jody Ernst talking about how she carries a gun because she may need to take on her government. I mean, there's no shortage of dog whistle to revolution, to violent revolution even, happening on the right. I think it hasn't gone any farther than that, in part because our police powers are pretty drastic, and in part because people feel really beat down right now. But what do you think?
Beat down.
Yeah.
Disgusted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you've got Americans who are massively in debt, desperately need whatever job they have student loan debt that cannot be discharged through bankruptcy. They're basically and you have a criminal justice system that puts people in prison for not paying their debts, and a whole, you know, debt collection system that is very, very sophisticated about nailing people in ways that they don't even know about, so that bench warrants get issued so that they end up actually going to jail for not paying their debts. You know, we've brought back debtors' prisons in this country. There's a lot of people who are just frankly afraid of ruining their lives by taking on the system, by protesting or whatnot. And this has been the punishment for a lot of the Occupy people, is that they've been charged with felonies just so that they'll have a felony record, so that they can never vote again. They can never get a decent job again. It's all about destroying the lives of dissidents. Tom, thanks for the call. These are dark days in this country. There's no way around that. And that's one of the reasons that it's not enough to just vote. We have to get politically active and bring this country back to some semblance of sanity. Going as past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike in Fairfax, Virginia. Listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Mike, you would like to present the Republican rebuttal?
Oh, I have a question, but that I'd like to ask you. But I wanted to respond to a popular talking point you used on Daryl, and it's the one about you can use your gun ID to vote, but not your student ID or military ID. And that's true. And I would recommend that all your listeners download the Texas Form DL-57 and read why that is. There's some other sites you can find. But the bottom line is probably 90% of the people with the military ID in Texas are registered in their home state. And so the ID doesn't convey residency. They could vote absentee from whatever other 49 states they're from. Same thing with the college ID. It's issued by a private institution, not the state.
No, actually, state colleges, those IDs are not valid either.
Yeah, I know that, and that's what I'm saying. There's no way for the poll worker to know whether the student attending that academic university is in-state or out-of-state.
Mike, you're operating under a rather tragic misconception, and that is that there are actually people out there who want to risk going to prison for 5 years and are so eager to do so that they're willing to show up in person and commit voter fraud. It's happened twice in the last 15 years in Texas. And in both cases, it was a felon who didn't realize that they'd lost their right to vote. Twice.
I just wish you would explain the fair fact that the gun ID is issued by the state and has an affirmation of state residency with it. Student IDs and military IDs do not. And that is the reason why.
It doesn't matter, Mike.
So
it doesn't matter. You're debating the efficacy of a problem of a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. It's like you and me sitting around debating whether or not scrubbing your skin with salt will cure you of Ebola when none of us have Ebola.
Well,
there is no voting fraud. There is no need for these ID laws.
It's a great talking point. I just wanted to explain the reason why.
No, it's not a reason why. That's a rationalization for Republican voter suppression, by and large, of poor people, students, minorities, older people, and disabled people, who you and I both know are more likely to vote for Democrats than Republicans.
So here's the question. When Harry Reid comes back for his farewell tour as Senate Majority Leader, and they're only in Congress for a couple of weeks, I think they come back November 12th, and it's about 3 weeks. Would you rather see him focus on getting a budget through so the government doesn't shut down in December, or jamming through a bunch of crony Obama people as appointees to score cheap political points? Because both of those aren't going to happen in the 3 weeks they've got.
Well, a lot depends on whether or not Mitch McConnell decides to continue the obstruction that he's been doing, requiring 30 hours of debate on every single nominee and filibustering virtually any kind of reasonable policies. First of all, your question is sort of like, are you still beating your wife? Which of these two horrible alternatives do you want? And it presupposes a Republican Senate. I'm not willing to presuppose a Republican Senate. And I do know that no matter how you try to frame it, what's been going on for the last 6 years in this country is Republicans have been trying to destroy President Obama's presidency. There's just no other way to say it. They have been succeeding in destroying President Obama's presidency and his legacy. They're doing it for the most craven of political reasons. And they're doing it right out in the open. And the thing that is astonishing to me is that the press won't acknowledge it. You get those Chuck Todd clips? This is Chuck Todd. Was this on Meet the Press? Yeah, this is Chuck Todd on Meet the Press. Again, failing to acknowledge that on January 20th, 2009, a group of the most powerful and influential Republicans in the United States got together for a four-hour private meeting in the Caucus Room restaurant with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich. Newt has come on this program and bragged about this. Got together and swore to each other that they would do everything they could to destroy the Obama presidency. Kevin McCarthy, who is now the Republican whip in the House, having replaced Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy after that meeting said, we're going to oppose him on every single piece of legislation. Pete Sessions, the Republican congressman from Texas, told the National Journal that the Republicans had learned from the Taliban how to disrupt somebody, that they were going to become the insurgency. So here's Chuck Todd.
We asked voters what the most important issue was to them in deciding how they would vote next week. And what did we find? Two things that aren't going to help any incumbents, Republican or Democrat. And the first is more than just an issue. It's an atmosphere. Voters are most concerned with breaking the partisan gridlock in Washington to get things done. It was one of the top two issues for likely voters in four of the six states we polled, including two big ones, Iowa and Kansas, where it was the top issue. But even in North Carolina and Arkansas, breaking the gridlock was a close third.
Now, notice he never points out that the gridlock is entirely a Republican construct. And the result of a very specific Republican conspiracy. There's another piece to this. Here's the second clip of Chuck Todd.
Believe it or not, breaking the dysfunction in Washington is popping as an issue. It's trumping the economy in some states. It trumps health care in just about every state. And this is sure to be the wild card with just 10 days to go until this year's midterm elections. They want to punish the Democrats without rewarding the Republicans.
Right. They want to punish the Democrats without rewarding the Republicans. Rewarding the Republicans for what? For gridlock. For, I guess. But, you know, why can't the press just come out and say this? I mean, Senator Sanders has pointed it out. It's not like it's a secret. Robert Draper wrote a book about it called When the Tea Party Came to Town. You can read about it. What we have is this: Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Henselman, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. They got together the night that the president and his wife were dancing at the inaugural balls. And at that point in time, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month. On that night, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month. And basically, well, here's what Pete Sessions said. Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire process. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side. Right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
Mitch McConnell. Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. David Perdue running against Ms. Nunn down in Florida, or in Georgia, excuse me. Thank you. He said, I never said I outsourced jobs. I outsourced production. Right. He really believes that the voters of Georgia are that stupid. It's just incredible. Meanwhile, John Boehner has this. This is just the list right on Daily Kos right now. John Boehner has not bothered to file his lawsuit to stop the Obama dictatorship. Remember that lawsuit he was going to file? I guess just talking about it was enough to raise a whole bunch of money for the Republicans. And Mitch McConnell has said, "Yeah, okay, 500,000 Kentuckians getting Medicaid expansion. Screw them. We are going to." We're going to end that. It's pretty amazing. Pete in West Henrietta, New York. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Actually, it's Rochester, but I'm in Pittsburgh, so you Rochester covers it all.
Okay.
The Atlantic, Jordan Weissman on January 2014 had an article titled, "Here's exactly how much the government would have to spend to make public college tuition free."
Right.
A mere $62.6 billion. According to a new Department of Education data, that's how much tuition public colleges collected from undergraduates in 2012 across the entire United States. And I'm not being facetious with the word mere either. The New American Foundation says that the federal government spent a whole $69 billion in 2013 on its hodgepodge of financial aid programs such as Pell Grants for low-income students, tax breaks, work study funding, and that doesn't even include loans.
Right.
When you stop and think about, if my memory is not failing me, the GI Bill returned $7 for every dollar invested.
That's right.
This is insane.
I agree. I absolutely agree. What you're seeing right now in our energy policy, you know, let's build out more natural gas rather than more solar. Let's subsidize carbon. The Keystone XL pipeline. In our education policy, student loans, jacking up prices, privatizing education, privatizing public schools, you know, handing them over to for-profit corporations. By the way, this is something that was done back in the 60s in Chile by the dictator Pinochet at the suggestion of Milton Friedman. And now the Chileans are demanding that the schools be made public again. There's a huge kerfuffle going on down in Chile about this right now. But, you know, basically what we're seeing is that every sector of our government where there's a fair amount of money sloshing around, the conservatives and the billionaire predators have either figured out a way to get their hands on it, in the case of public education, in the case of energy policy, or they're trying to figure out how to get their hands on it, in the case of Social Security and Medicare. And it's just what we are seeing is the capture of government by really rich people facilitated by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's a crime against democracy. And it is the number one thing that we need to be challenging is this whole idea that money is the same thing as speech and corporations are the same thing as people, because it leads to this kind of stupidity. Pete, thank you. Excellent point. $62 billion. We spend that in Afghanistan and Iraq in, what, a couple of weeks? Lois in Shreveport, Louisiana. Hey, Lois, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I really, really enjoy your show every day.
Thank you, Lois.
You kind of caught me off guard because I've been waiting to talk to you, and I was on the computer, so it shocked me when I heard your name.
Okay.
But I have two comments to make.
Okay.
One is I enjoy how you handle your guests, such as Darryl Green.
Mm-hmm.
I think my mom always said, if you're walking on one side of the street and you look on the other side of the street and two people are arguing, you don't know who the fool is. So when I watch your show, you do not argue with them. I know it's frustrating to you, but that's what I admire about you, how you handle your show.
Well, thank you, Lois.
Okay. That's one thing. And I did donate because I was kind of nervous. I want to keep y'all on TV.
Mm.
And another thing is I had a question to ask. I talked to someone in Texas, and he was talking about retirement. So I retired when I got 62, because I worked at a plant for 32 years, and I never hardly missed a day. So I had a nice chunk of change. And he said he could not retire in Texas. If he did at age 62, they would penalize him. Can you kind of clear that up for me?
I don't know. Federal retirement benefits, Social Security benefits, are the same everywhere in the country, to the best of my knowledge. The variations that could exist are, one, some states have there was a waiver to Social Security, and this was built in fairly close to the beginning. There were a bunch of waivers to Social Security, and they've kind of closed that up over time. But in some states, and I believe Texas is one of them, if you are a state employee, if you're a teacher, for example, or you work for the government, then you're actually not eligible for Social Security. You pay into a state-run pension fund, which may or may not produce the kind of return Social Security does. I don't know. That's one possibility. Another is that, Reagan instituted income taxes on Social Security. I'm assuming that in states where you pay an income tax, that is all, you know, the state also taxes your Social Security. I could be wrong on that, but Texas doesn't have a state income tax, so that can't be it. So I'm not sure what he's talking about. It could just be, Lois, that, you know, he didn't earn enough money throughout his life to have a very substantial Social Security return. Do you know?
That's my exact thought. That's what I thought, but I wasn't sure because I don't know. That's
yeah.
When I called your show.
Yeah, it's one of those, well, it's not the state income tax thing, but it's probably, my guess would be that either he spent a lot of his life not making a lot of money or not making any money,
yeah.
Or he spent a lot of his life working in one of those exempted jobs where you don't pay Social Security. Social Security exempted agricultural workers, too, originally, and maids. And there were a lot of positions that were exempted that were the people who are, shall we say, on the margins of society, which back in 1935 included most African Americans. And they were exempted because of the racism that was, you know, this was the only way that FDR could get this bill through a white Congress was to include those kinds of exemptions. Most of those have been filled and replaced, a lot of them in the early 60s. during the Kennedy and LBJ administrations. So, but there are still some of these exemptions for public employees. So I just don't know, Lois. Thank you for the call, though. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. David in Springfield, Ohio. Hey, David, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. You know, I'm getting tired of these predictions. It says, like, you know, Republicans are going to win, do well here in Ohio, and Casey's going to get reelected. I'm, you know, it's a people's side to vote, not these critics. And I think Kasich is arrogant. He doesn't follow the golden rule. He's conceited. He's just making life. He believes that everyone should get around by car. Now, I have a driver's license, but I can't afford to maintain a car. I think we should have high-speed trains through Ohio, but he's against that because when he was in the U.S. House of Representatives, he didn't take kindly to Amtrak.
Right.
I think, you know, Fitzgerald, well, he cares about people. I think he's more a follower of the golden rule, and he's more considerate. And so I think he should be elected governor.
Yeah. Well, you don't hear me doing a lot of politics as sports on this program. I'm not convinced that anybody is necessarily going to win. I think there's a lot of races that are relatively up in the air. They wouldn't be up in the air if it wasn't for hundreds of millions of dollars and being thrown into these races by right-wing billionaires, particularly the Koch brothers, and their network of people, and Karl Rove and his network of people. But they are, and you know, we'll see how it shakes out. David, thanks for the call. I'm with you on John Kasich. You know, this whole thing of cutting 36,000 people off food stamps, unless they work 20 hours a week for, like, what, $20 worth of, or $15 worth of food stamps, unless they work 20 hours a week picking up trash by the highway. Let's pay them 50 cents an hour and pay them in food. Right. Yeah, brilliant, brilliant, these Republicans. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, you wanted to talk about voter ID?
Yeah, I also have a question I've been meaning to ask for months. But anyway, on the caller who was talking about voter ID, mm-hmm. It sounded like he was conflating, as I think many people do, is that if you've got a student ID, military ID, then you automatically get to vote. But the only thing those IDs are for is just to show that you are that person. As far as being eligible to vote, you actually have to, when you register, show other ID, proof of citizenship, residency.
Right. I had to show an electric bill, prove that I live where I live.
Yeah. And that's already done. It's not like you can just go up and vote, you know, with just a military ID. You have to do all those other things. And I think they are, a lot of people are wrongly believing, you know, that you can just walk up with military ID, and that's all.
You're right. Dan, we just have about 30 seconds left. You had another question?
I'll make this quick. I was wondering if there's a difference between equal opportunity and equal protection. You know, is equal opportunity a subset? And the reason is I think, like, as far as pursuing voter ID and other suppression, it'd be easier if we called it equal opportunity. And, like, a case in point is, like, when, let's say, one district lines, you know, you vote in, like, half an hour someplace else. It takes you 8 hours to vote.
Right.
Now, that's not equal opportunity if you have to wait 8 hours.
No, it's not. Here's the thing, though. We don't have a constitutional right to vote. If you are of a certain protected class under the Constitution, you can't be prevented from voting, but you don't have a constitutional right to vote. And that needs to be fixed.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, Dan, that's why the frame you're using doesn't work, because it would only work if you had an explicit right. We really need a constitutional amendment that says that we have a right to vote. Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court, no explicit right to vote.
Welcome back.
Huh. Yeah, it's like it's over 80 degrees in here, so. Gloria in Lumberbridge, North Carolina. Hey, Gloria, what's on your mind? Gloria? Gloria?
Hello? Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, I had you on speaker, and I was having a time getting it out.
Okay. What's up?
Listen, my comments are on the Social Security situation. Mm-hmm. I'm a disability Social Security. I heard the guy from Monroe speaking earlier. Mm-hmm. What a lot of people don't understand either, if you don't pay anything in Social Security, you don't get anything out. Disability is different. It's an entitlement program. It's not, it's, you know, it means you, it's according to means. but as far as a person that's paid in, the up until they got were ill or whatever, that is Social Security, and you paid into that. That's
right.
Insurance.
Yeah, the original idea, the idea was that Social Security would be there for working people who didn't have a pension to prevent them from slipping into poverty when they stopped working. And and in 1935, almost nobody had a pension. And I think that it should be expanded to include people who don't work for money but who do work. I think that stay-at-home moms or dads, for that matter, they're working. I was a stay-at-home dad for a year. I can tell you it's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work. I know what you mean. But it just like – and another thing people don't understand either, you think about – And God help them, the thousands of people that die every year that have worked in their entire lives and paid in, and then they don't have any beneficiaries to receive this.
Yeah.
That's money that's paid in.
Right.
My entire, just about, I'm one of six as far as being my siblings. Mm. There are two of us left. The other four died before they were 55.
Right.
My oldest sister was 3 months shy of her 55th birthday.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And all of the money that they paid in, now most of them had well-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They paid into Social Security. My brother, he was 44 when he died. Mm-hmm. He had well-paying jobs all his life.
Mm-hmm.
But when my mother retired, she got $157 a month because she worked we were sharecroppers all her life, and that's a whole other story of the way that sharecroppers were done.
Right. But she earned so little.
Yeah. And they were not, they didn't pay in anything if they could help it, the farm owners.
Right.
They could help it. They didn't pay in anything. But she got $157 a month because she did, once she got off the farm, work for maybe 10, 12 years, $157 a month.
That's nothing.
My brother picked up the slack and carried her as a dependent.
Right.
So when he passed away, she was able to draw his Social Security.
Oh, that's good.
But all the others, there was nobody to draw their Social Security.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's...
It's a system that needs some calibration and fine-tuning. But it's a very difficult time in this political atmosphere to say that and try and do something about it. If we were to convene some sort of a commission to, as Reagan did in 81 with Greenspan Daniel Patrick Moynihan, if we were to convene some sort of a commission right now, the Republicans would get in there and privatize the damn thing. Thank you, Gloria. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. It's the True People's Media. Gary in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. A question and a comment.
Okay.
Boy, used up all my time saying that. Social Security. I made $1.5 million in my career. In 2009, my at-will company eliminated my position when I was 60 years old. I looked for a job for 2 years. I lived in Southern California. Impossible to find a job because of ageism and also economics. So I was forced to take early Social Security when I turned 62. So as a result, that cost me $800 a month.
Wow.
I'm looking for reparations for that from Congress, which I'll never get.
Yeah.
Second comment is that the 1.7% increase will pay one of my co-pays every month. It's $31 a month, I believe, on $1,850. So that, I looked at my new card this year for Medicare, and the copays for specialists have gone up from $30 to $40.
Huh.
They kind of snuck that in.
So one hand gives, the other hand takes.
Exactly. And, to me, that's, unbelievable how we take, you know, so well, let us a life of some a modicum of comfort, I live in a life of poverty.
Let us not forget, Gary, that Social Security was proposed by a Democratic president, was passed by a Democratic Congress, was opposed by virtually all the Republicans in Congress. Over the years since then, has been consistently opposed by Republicans year after year after year. The Republicans are leading an effort to privatize it, to cut it, to eviscerate it, to ruin it. Same thing with Medicare. When Medicare was passed in the 1960s, Ronald Reagan recorded a 33 LP album talking about how this was going to put us on the road to socialism, and someday we'd look back and remember fondly the days when America was free. This was going to turn us into the Soviet Union. Republicans have been steady, steadfast opponents to Medicare. They're sort of cozying up to Medicare now because they've been able to drill enough holes in it that now it's around a $5 or $6 billion a year industry associated with Medicare, providing insurance, private insurance, private for-profit insurance to fill in those Medicare holes. But it's still, actually, it's probably a much larger industry than that. But the net of this is, if we want this fixed, we need to get more Democrats in Congress. We need to get more Democrats in our state houses. We need to get more Democratic governors. We need to get more Democrats in the Senate. And that, you know, it's a vote for Republicans is a vote against Social Security. It's that simple. Gary, thanks for the call. Excellent points. Bob in Lafayette, Georgia. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I was just wondering about, I seen a program, something about ACLU. Can you explain what that is and who they are, what they represent?
Sure. The ACLU is an acronym for the American Civil Liberties Union, and it is an organization that looks out specifically for your First Amendment rights, your free speech rights. They believe that the principal civil liberties that we have are the right to peaceably assemble and petition our government for redress of grievance, and to speak. And so they've defended over the years a lot of things that have been popular and a lot of things that have been unpopular. Probably the most famous example is back in, I think it was in the late 60s, when a group of Nazis wanted to march through Skokie, Illinois, which is a largely Jewish neighborhood, and at that time had a lot of Holocaust survivors, Jews who had fled Germany, living in it, which is why the Nazis picked it. And the local community tried to ban them from marching, saying that it was offensive what they were doing. And the ACLU came in and said, even if speech is offensive, it's protected by the First Amendment. And they defended the Nazis, and they won, actually, in that case. So the ACLU, what the ACLU is all about is protecting the First Amendment and the things that are protected by the First Amendment, freedom of religion, free speech, and the right to peaceably assemble and petition your government for redress of grievance. Have I answered your question, Bob?
Were they one of the responsible for the Ten Commandments being not displayed and nativity scenes not being displayed in certain areas?
The American Civil Liberties Union has argued, I believe. There are other groups I know that are arguing this. The Freedom From Religion Foundation, and there's a few others. But I believe that the ACLU may have argued that government should not be financing religion. That's, you know, if you breach that wall between government and religion in either direction, it's not a good thing.
We're taken down from the courthouses.
I don't, you know.
I heard that they were had prayer taken out of the schools.
Yeah, I wouldn't surprise me. I don't know that it was the ACLU. It may well have been. Probably was. Do you really want your children going to your elementary school to be saying prayers to Satan?
No, not to Satan.
Okay. Well, if you're going to say that the state can force children to experience religion, then you have to make that available to all religions. And there's a satanic temple in New York City that is starting to go into these communities where you have local government-sponsored religion, whether it's Ten Commandments on the outside of a courtroom, or whether it's kids saying prayers in the classrooms or before football games, and they're saying, hey, what about Satan? You should be praying to Satan. If you're going to pray to Jesus, you need to pray to Satan. And it's a strong argument. And this is why James Madison, his first veto, when he became president in 1809, His first veto was against giving federal money to churches here in Washington, D.C. to pay for a poorhouse. As he said, federal government should never be involving itself in religion. And this is from a guy who was a Christian, because he was concerned that the religion, the institute, religious institutions would be corrupted by the government. So, Bob, if the ACLU did those things, I'm all in favor of it. I would like my religion and other people's religions to remain pure, not to be state contaminated. We'll see you tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a good one.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.